you know, just so you know, this has nothing to do with climate change. It has nothing to do. The violence there isn't about an ongoing war that would imply that both sides are armed and are going at each other. This is a genocide, and it's a genocide that targets Christians.
Greetings and welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I'm Alex Kochman, Director of Communications and Engagement with ABWE, joined again, as always, actually reunited with my partner in crime.
And it feels so good. Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful. Scott W. Dunford, pastor of Western Hills Church in San Mateo, California. And here we go again on another exhilarating expedition into the enclaves of missiology and missiological endeavors. How's that for some alliteration?
I like it.
Didn't even use ChatGPT like the last time. Anyways, we're so glad that you've joined us here. And Scott, we want to get right into today's conversation with a guest. I'm very excited to discuss this topic with. I've seen lots of interest lately, thankfully, in the persecution that our brothers and sisters are facing in Nigeria. At the same time, I'm sure it's a matter of mere minutes before it's out of the American collective consciousness. Our attention spans are so fleetingly short. And so maybe in God's grace, this conversation will do what little we can from here we are in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, from our studio to just make a little bit more impact and help people think about this, because so often, you know, out of sight, out of mind, right? But it's critically important that we recognize what's happening in this part of the world, isn't it, brother?
It is. And so we've been talking about this for a while, but we're excited after seeing some of the stuff that our next guest, Larry Taunton, has been posting. And he's been engaged with the Nigerian church for a long time. Of course, you probably know him from different apologetic things that he's done. But Larry, we're so glad to have you on the show. And I just kind of want to dive right into it. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved with Nigeria and then this massive story of you getting into Nigeria, dealing with what's going on kind of in that contested region and what you've discovered and kind of what's happened since then.
Sure. I was doing a theological degree and met a Nigerian bishop who was pursuing the same degree that I was. And I was doing this just, you know, part time some years ago. And we got to know each other. And it's pretty funny because I'm so low church. You know, I just knew him as Juan. And people would say to me, you know, in his own country, they kiss his ring and they call him bishop. You know, Jombez, and Anglican bishop, a real lion for the faith and a very humble, remarkable man. But upon learning that I was a writer, a freelancer who, you know, particularly in those days before everything went very hard, you know, to the left, I kind of played the role of one of the conservative voices in places like The Atlantic or CNN or USA Today, what have you. And I had expressed a great interest, concern for the persecuted church. And he invited me to Nigeria. And I think he was wasn't really expecting I would come because he had invited many others who did not go. And I told him, no, I will go. I will come. I want to see it firsthand. I want to be able to report on this and hopefully bring some attention to this. So I did. I wrote a piece for Fox News detailing that experience and all that I saw, called The Forgotten Christians of Nigeria. You can find that piece online. You can find it on my website. I've recently posted it on my Twitter account. But I flew into Abuja, which is kind of the center part of the country, was met there and hidden in an automobile and driven 6 hours to the north. And what people need to understand about what's happening in Nigeria is it's not new. Meaning you could get the impression that because Nigeria is in the news again for Christian persecution, that it's intensified. It hasn't intensified. It's as bad as it has been for the last 25 years. It's just that for some reason, right now, it's getting a little bit of attention. And I'm thrilled with that because this is something that I feel very passionate about. I have a number of friends there, dear people, brave people who have suffered horribly for their faith at the hands of the Boko Haram, the Fulani Herdsmen Militia, both of which are Islamic terrorist groups. And this started in the north around the year 2000, and then has gradually sort of crept southward. But the, you know, kind of stories, the kinds of things that I was seeing are really just horrific things that are taking place there, and that, frankly, the average Westerner, and especially an American, just can't comprehend.
Tell us a little bit about what you saw. You've made reference in your recent X thread, Twitter thread. It still sounds strange to say X, but you mentioned Nigeria is the most dangerous place in the world for Christians. You referred to demographic warfare. That's quite a vivid term. So tell us what happened.
Maybe one of the best ways to relate this is to just simply relate my own specific experience. You see, once you get outside of the airport, you see virtually no white people. Now, the southern part of the country is safer. Lagos and Abuja, by that I mean safer by Nigerian standards. They're both dangerous cities, but probably no worse than downtown Chicago. And, you know, but in the north of the country, the central part of the country, things have changed wildly. So when you're flying into Nigeria, you're on a plane that's, you know, that's half empty. The white people who are on those planes are invariably working for an embassy, working for a government, or they're working for an oil company. And they're swiftly picked up by armed security, taken away in armored cars. Now, I have a whole theory on, you know, bodyguards and how effective they can or cannot be in certain situations. And given, you know, what I do in some other third world countries. So I decided to forgo bodyguards. But my Nigerian hosts, you know, were very concerned for my safety because, you know, from their point of view, they say, look, you know, as Nigerians, it's dangerous for us to be on these open roads. But for you, it's incredibly dangerous because you're, you know, quite obviously, you know, Western. And they would say, you know, you're almost a cowboy, you know, so you just, everything about you says that you're an American. You have this shock of white hair, and I'm a white man, and I'm 6'3". So I'm quite tall compared to the average Nigerian. It's funny that the bishop introduced me. The legend all over Africa is that Nigerians are enormous people. You see, the Africa is afraid of Nigeria. So the average African will say, I would never go to Nigeria. And it's funny, you hear all over Africa, Nigerians are enormous people. And I was telling this to the bishop on one occasion, and he just howled. And he said, well, as you can see, we're like Asians. He says, we're quite small. But you're of the tribe of Anak. And so, you know, he introduced me when I was speaking at the cathedral. He said, I want to introduce you to the tallest man in Africa. You know, so just a little bit of an inside joke there. But the fact of the matter is, you know, being picked up, having to be hidden because I am white, and this isn't really so much about race, it's about money. It's about the fact that people identify you, recognize you're Western, that you might be valuable, you might be worth kidnapping. And so when you get, you know, way into the northern part of the country, you see almost no white people, except for the occasional missionary who has been there for a period of time that the Nigerians and even those who might want to steal from them have already dismissed them as people who've got nothing, who are worth nothing. And so you might see the occasional, but very, very rarely. I think in a week in the north, I saw one white man going through garbage and everybody just kind of ignoring him. And I was being, it was told that he was some sort of missionary, had been there for decades. So, you know, that's part of the problem. Add to this the fact that the violence there is, it's not anomalous. It's part of the strategy. So they target Christian. You know, just so you know, this has nothing to do with climate change. It has nothing to do. The violence there isn't about an ongoing war that would imply that both sides are armed and are going at each other. This is a genocide, and it's a genocide that targets Christians. It targets Christians. It targets them specifically because they are Christians. It targets them because Islam says that you are doing a great good, earning Allah's favor by killing infidels, specifically Christians and Jews. So that's what's going on there. So here I am going to the north. You're going through burned out, you know, villages. You're going through places. I posted a few pictures where I'm hiding in the back seat, and I, you know, lift my camera up and I take a few photos where we're going through military checkpoints, going through little villages where tires are put out in the road that are flaming. And the reason for that is because the Fulani herdsmen sometimes attack in the militia, sometimes attack in, you know, in automobiles, you know, something like a Hilux, like Toyota's pickup trucks with mounted machine guns in the back. And so they throw these flaming tires out into the middle of the road to slow them down so that they can get a shot off at them to try to defend themselves. You know, we're going past some case, you know, a burning village. Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of things that you are seeing. I'm placed into a home where for them, it was a very nice place. I was very honored because these were people who were prepared to die for me. Mm. I mean, they're really remarkable, beautiful Christian people, both literally and in the spiritual sense here. But they placed me in a home that was way nicer than what any of them could possibly be in, has rebar on all the windows, and it's locked from outside. Mm. So think about this. So I'm thinking to myself, I have no way out of this. If there's a fire, I can get, there's no back door. There's just the front door, which is reinforced steel with multiple locks. They're not trying, this was for my protection, to be clear. I wasn't being made a captive. And rebar, there's no way out if I have to get out of this place. Next morning, you know, they come for me the very first day. The bishop himself comes for me. And it takes me a little while to know that he's in the house. He's calling my name. And I don't remember if I was, you know, in the shower or what was happening. But anyway, it took me 5 minutes. And when I did finally come to him and say, hey, you know, it's good to see you this morning. He had this, he looked grief stricken. He looked alarmed and then relieved. And I was like, hey, what's wrong? And he said, kind of speaking with almost with this, you know, it's kind of a sonorous, you know, it was once a British mm-hmm. colony. So they speaks kind of with a sonorous old school British accent that's a little Yoda-like. Mm. And so I get there and he says, I feared something terrible had happened to you during the night, meaning that you had been murdered or kidnapped or something like that, because it'd take you, I mean, imagine that in your own house. Somebody knocks on your door and you take a few minutes to get there. They don't immediately jump to the conclusion that you've been murdered or macheted to death. And then we're about to go down this highway again across the desert. And the Sahara Desert reaches into the north of Nigeria. And we pull off to the side of the road, and his driver, I don't say this in the Twitter thread, his driver changes clothes. He puts on a police uniform. And then he says, we have to move you to the back seat. We have to lay down the seat and hide you in the back seat. And I said, why is he putting on a police uniform? Is he a policeman? He says, no, but they will think that he's a policeman and they will wave us through some of the military checkpoints, but they can't see you in the automobile. If they see a white man, phones will start ringing everywhere that there is a white man in the north. And that will get big attention. And as we're about to get back in the car, we're looking down one of these roads, like in an old Roadrunner cartoon, you know, where it's just, you're watching the road, you know, go off into the disappearing point, you know, like in Nevada, you know, or something like that. And he says, we know not what dangers lurk for you in the desert. And I thought, you know, you just sounded exactly like Yoda, you know, and you were saying this to me. It was like a movie line. So the point being, I had to be hidden in that kind of fashion. Then occasionally, you know, I, you know, of course, would be seen. And it did attract attention. But the idea is to get in and out before anybody can really organize anything to attack you. But something I would really want to emphasize in an interview like this to people who are listening, because I've written an essay on this just in one of my books, my last book called Around the World in More Than 80 Days, Around the World in More Than 80 Days. I have a chapter on Nigeria, and I talk about danger, you know, the Western attitude towards danger. And the Western attitude towards danger is generally, even among Christians, I had some friends, you know, who were very condemning, you know, of me, saying, how foolish of you to do this. How foolish of you to risk your life like this. You know, earlier this year, I was, you know, in Cairo, and I have a standoff with the secret police outside of USAID who are clearly there to disappear me. Last year and years before, I'm flying into single prop planes into cartel towns in South America to follow the USAID and the Biden administration's massive human trafficking operation. And occasionally I have friends who will say, it's very foolish of you to do that. You don't need to do that. You do that with a Zoom call. And I think I feel contempt for that. I understand it, but I feel contempt for that attitude. And I do for this reason. There are occasions where it's quite appropriate to do something via Zoom. But some of these things do require somebody to put boots on the ground. So in the case of, you know, going to Darien, you know, in South America, or, you know, the jungles of Colombia, where these migrant prior to Trump's inauguration, these migrant caravans are going. You know, I realized when I was doing an interview with Steve Bannon, and Trump texted Bannon during the interview and said, tell him that this is incredibly important information and I will act on this, and for him to give me a flow chart of what's happening here. Because this was an aspect of USAID they didn't know about. I would have been screaming it in every interview that there's a massive human trafficking operation. And afterwards, I said to my wife, I said, isn't it interesting that the president of the United States, with all who can pick up a phone and move a fleet from one ocean to another and send cruise missiles, you know, anywhere, and satellites everywhere, and move armies, that he still depends on intrepid people to go places to tell him things that he otherwise would not have known. But also in the case of our brothers and sisters who are suffering, it means everything to them to risk something on their behalf. And so, you know, I was very mindful of the fact that they invited me to speak at the cathedral surrounded by Muslims who are sitting on the wall around. You look through the windows and see them gazing in as I'm speaking. And there was a high degree of nervousness, but I got to tell you, I don't know that anything I said, I'd love to say that I gave a brilliant message, a brilliant sermon. They were, I cannot tell you how kind they were to me. You know, the bishop saying to me, they would carry you away as their champion. And I said, why is that? And he said, because your willingness to come here means everything. And it does. And it really moves me to say it, because as I said, I'd love to say that I'd given such a brilliant message. They just loved it. I don't know that they cared about anything I had to say. I think what they cared about was they wanted to know, does the Western church actually even know we exist? Do they know what is happening to us here? We are being slaughtered here, and no one is talking about it. Every time we invite someone to come, they never come. They say we'll Zoom call you. We'll send you, you know, a little bit of money. And you're the first that has come in years and dared to come to the North. Now, I'm not saying that to say, you know, what kind of a hero I am. Rather, what I'm trying to say is the Western church has the ability, for how long, I don't know, but the Western church has the ability to bring serious artillery to bear, maybe literal artillery to bear in a circumstance like this. They are besieged. They need support. The president of the United States has offered to give it. We need to encourage the president of the United States to give it.
So, Larry, I mean, I talked to a pastor who's from Nigeria, hasn't lived there in a number of years, asked him this very question, like, what's going on? Why aren't we hearing more about this? And even he was kind of like, I don't really know. Maybe it's some kind of tribal thing, right? We Alex and I have been posting on this for months now and very little traction. And then all of a sudden, it's just now it's in the news and everyone's talking about it. But like, you know, what do you chalk that up to? Is there a conspiracy to hide this? Why are the international bodies not dealing with this? Why don't people up until just the last like couple weeks? Why was no one talking about this, even though we're hearing from source after source after source that this is a massive genocide of Christians?
Scott, that's a great question. And it's funny because I called the bishop just last week And I said, hey, what has happened there that now this is suddenly getting attention? He said, nothing unusual. It's business as usual. We're still being slaughtered, as we all have been. I said, are you seeing any media there on the ground? He goes, no, there's nobody here. They're not here on the ground. He said, I think some videos maybe just happened to percolate to the surface on social media that are actually old videos, but they represent what's happening now, that are starting to get a little circulation in the United States. And so once again, it's bringing attention to it. The last time attention was drawn to this was during Trump's first term. Some of you may you may remember that in 2016, Trump was talking about this then and threatened Nigeria then, just as he has now. But you see, the Biden administration and the Obama administrations, they weren't interested in talking about this. And indeed, there is a conspiracy to keep this hidden, to keep the real. I mean, in the same way, by the way, that the knife attacks that are taking place, you know, in all across Europe, the shootings, the beheadings, where, you know, the EU rules state that you can't state the ethnicity or maybe even the name of the person who's responsible for a beheading. And we're going, well, I think we all know that it wasn't Lutherans, you know, who did that. but there's been a real effort. And of course, it's the, you know, the so-called red-green alliance, the alliance between, the, we've just saw it with the election of Mondani. And that is the cooperation between the radical left and between Islamists, because they have a shared enemy. And who's the shared enemy? Well, it's Christianity. As Christians, they're both seek to wipe them out. So in the case of media, a lot of Arab money is flowing into the West, and that it is having a huge impact on media coverage on these things. So, yes, this is absolutely being suppressed.
So we've got about 6 minutes left. We're on our last lap. What do you recommend that Christians in the States do? Obviously, pray. It sounds like there has to be a political dimension to this as well. And as much as it's important for us to remember that we have spiritual weapons at the ready, not just carnal weapons, at the same time, when you have acts of violence, that is the purpose for which the Lord ordained the civil magistrate, right? And I'm even curious, you know, what is the Nigerian government doing? Are they suppressing this as well? Maybe, you know, this side of the pond, there's ignorance. Is that the case there on the ground as well? So maybe speak to that as well. But then ultimately, what are you hoping that the average believer does with this information?
Well, I would say I would love to be able to tell you, maybe you guys can do this on a subsequent episode. I would love to name some very reputable organizations that are helping the persecuted church, specifically in Nigeria. Unfortunately, I don't know them, but you guys might ferret that out and recommend where people might go with that. But the Nigerian government they're Muslims. So what they're doing is turning the other way. They're facilitating the attacks while pretending not to. You see, it's the same strategy that we're seeing in Saqib Khan's London, and it's what we'll see coming very soon to Mondani's New York. And that's where you will begin seeing a great increase in sexual violence, rape, huge increase. I just had lunch with a man from Stockholm, and he was talking about the skyrocketing, sexual violence perpetrated by Muslims in his country. I've been there. I've seen it. It's real. It's true. You're going to see an increase in terrorism in those countries, and you're going to see the left pretend that it's not happening. There's nothing to see here. So it's the same strategy. If I were advising the president of the United States, I'd say, believe nothing the Nigerian government is telling you. They're lying. And we also have to get out of the UN. The UN is playing a role here. The UN has disarmed Christians in Nigeria, calling it a human rights violation for them to defend themselves. And it is a deeply corrupt organization.
Yeah, literally that is true. Using, they said that's, that they can't
that's
defend
literally
themselves?
True. Wow. Literally true. Some Christians within Nigerian Christians within their own churches, after they were attacked by the Boko Haram and the Fulani herdsmen militia, armed the people within their own churches. And when the Fulani next attacked, they bloodied them. They bloodied them. The UN came in and said human rights violation and disarmed the Christians, knowing very well that it made them vulnerable to attacks. So no, the government has facilitated this. The UN has facilitated this. These are corrupt organizations. So I'd want to say to the president, believe neither one of them. They're lying to you. And then get people on the ground, you know, like me, like others who are willing to go to advise you, because you're talking directly with the Christians in these places. Their voices need to be heard. You need to be talking to the pastors who will tell you what's happening to the Christians in their churches, how the boys are slaughtered, put to the machete, old women are killed, and girls are taken off into sex slavery. This is the way Islam works.
And for the ordinary person as well, Scott, maybe you can give us a few thoughts here as we close out as well. I think we need to make our voices heard publicly. I think even as frustrating as social media can be, social media is an outlet where our elected representatives do listen to us sometimes, right? If there's a critical mass, so we can make our voice known in that way as well. But then, Scott, maybe providing that pastoral perspective here for our last minute or two. What do we do? And then as we get into our overtime segment for our premium subscribers, missionspodcast.com/premium, or you can sign up through the Missions Podcast in Apple Podcasts as well to get access to our bonus segment that we'll record. I do want to talk about just this rising threat of Islam in historically non-Muslim places, what that looks like, how we think about that outside of Nigeria as well. So we can speak a little bit more to that in a moment. But Scott, some concluding thoughts from a pastoral perspective.
I mean, the one thing I would say is that, you know, when as pastors, we have this opportunity to pray often in our church services. I've got, you know, about a 5-minute window that I do a pastoral prayer, and I will regularly pray for the churches in Nigeria and for highlighting this particular issue. You know, and I think it's important that we, and Alex, and you and I were going back and forth on this on Twitter a little bit today, but like highlighting the dangers of Islam, but also recognizing that a lot of Muslims, they don't know much, you know, and not demonizing every single Muslim we meet, but seeing them as a person that needs to know the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so while we can definitely politically need to be against these systems that destroy, but also mm-hmm. we want to make sure that we're reaching the people that are in our community that need to know the gospel of Jesus Christ. So
Scott, can I interrupt you for 1 second there?
Yeah. Yeah.
It is true that not every Muslim is a terrorist or would be terrorist, but every Muslim who takes Islam seriously is. And that is because Islam we shouldn't have a single Muslim in the United States. And some people say, well, that's racist. No, no, it's not racist. It's a religion. It's a religion, and it is actually an ideology of conquest, an ideology of rape, an ideology of violence that feeds, it's invented by men to feed every perverse male appetite. That's what Islam is. And any Muslim who takes the Hadith, the Quran, and the life of Muhammad seriously, as they're all supposed to do, those are people that are as dangerous as any Nazi, as any communist, as any terrorist, because that's what the religion is.
We want to take every thought captive to the Lord Jesus Christ. We want to rescue people from systems of darkness and oppression and blindness and bring them into the light. And ultimately, that's our mission and our purpose in the world. You know, the phrase love the sin or not love the sin, but to
I
love
hear
the
what you're saying.
Hate
I,
the sin,
I hear what's going on with
and,
that.
And so, yeah, we hate and reject.
What are you sipping under there? Lies,
and yet we also want to pray and labor towards the rescue of those people. But we're hitting on some huge things here. And I do want to continue that conversation because I think there's some good back and forth here that we should press in on a little bit. And so we'll do that for our premium subscribers. How should
subscribe,
we think about
subscribe,
Islam? How should
get
we
in
think
on this.
About Muslims? So go ahead and join us at missionspodcast.com/premium as we continue the conversation for our bonus segment with Larry Alex Taunton. And thank you for joining us today, Larry. And also thank you. The Missions Podcast is a ministry of ABWE. And to learn more steps about how, or to learn more rather about how you can take your next steps in the Great Commission, You can do that at abwe.org. We've also got more copies of this book here, Missions by the Book. Myself and Chad Vegas, we've just got several of these, and we'd love to continue to give those away. A few of you wrote to us, and we'd love to send out a few more copies of that. So email alex@missionspodcast.com, as well as scott@missionspodcast.com, if you'd like to share any ideas or suggestions, or simply get your hands on some of these giveaways here. And we are grateful for each and every one of you who's engaged with the show. So until our next episode, or until our bonus segment, for those of you joining us for that behind the paywall, go make disciples of all the nations.